Good morning. It is 9:08, Wednesday, July 22nd. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, and in 1 week, I will officially be a Brooklynite again.
I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News, and I'd love to hear more about Joe moving back to Brooklyn.
Alan Carrasco, managing editor of the TDN. I'm happy to be back after about a month's absence, vacation and the like, and happy to talk horse racing because I don't get to do that since we don't sit in an office anymore. So looking forward to the chat.
Good to have you back. Next week I'll be recording the podcast from here and then jumping on a moving truck and heading to Brooklyn. So dedication.
You do it from the moving truck.
Yeah. It's hanging off the back. All right. TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Entries for the industry-leading 2020 Keeneland November Breeding Stock Sale to be held at the home of the Breeders' Cup World Championships are now open through August 3rd. Learn more at november.keeneland.com. So, big weekend of racing. Great to have Saratoga back. Obviously, a little eerie without the fans, but you know, it's just great to see them coming down that stretch at Saratoga. Great job to everybody at Fox Sports 1 and Naira. I think they did a really good job broadcasting throughout the weekend. It's not easy to do a full day of racing like that, especially when there's no, you know, fan or human interest stories really to do. They have some owners on the track. We saw our friends at West Point. Terry Finley was out there watching Decorated Invader. Some pretty good performances. I thought, you know, the grade one, I don't know that was really a grade one. Once Tonal Shake didn't show up, had a good stretch battle with a couple lightly raced fillies, Paris Lights and Crystal Ball. But I don't know. That didn't strike me as a true grade one race, but we did have some good performances. Like I said, Decorated Invader. We had a new TDN Rising Star and Momos, a Distorted Humor Colt in the opener on Saturday. We're going to talk to Christoph Clement a little bit about him and some other horses. Big weekend for the Clement barn. They also won the Lake Placid on Sunday with Speak to Me of Summer. Another stakes winner for Summerfront, who's really coming on. I believe he's third now, sole third place in black type winners behind American Pharoah and Constitution among second crop sires. Just great to have Saratoga back. You know, we questioned a little bit how much sense it made to ship everybody up there. It seems like the handle was up over the first week. Bill, I'll toss it to you and your impressions.
Well, so far as the racing goes, I totally agree with you. It was a great day for Windstar as they run 1-2 with their Windstar stablemates in the coaching club. But one of the reasons why that race didn't come up as strong as you would have hoped is, again, we're getting this glut of racing right now. And the coaching club never had to deal with the Ashland before. The Ashland was always in April. So you take the Ashland horses and the coaching club horses and put them in one race, which kind of would have been the case in a normal year, and you would have had a fantastic race. So far as these horses going on to the Kentucky Oaks, I don't think they're going to scare off Gamine or a Swiss Skydiver or anything like that. But Joe, I do think the real story out of Saratoga this week was the betting. And, you know, this is a racetrack where on-track business matters. You lose all that, and still they are up 9.4% over 2019 figures. And even more relevant, you know, we made this argument about whether or not it made sense to race at Saratoga, period, when there weren't going to be any fans in the stands. Why not just stay at Belmont? And Naira argued that, hey, even if we go to Saratoga, even if there's no fans there, the handle is going to be through the roof. And it looks like they're right. They put out figures that said $80 million was bet on the first 4 days of racing at Saratoga. And the comparable last 4 days of racing for the summer meet at Belmont was $41 million. That's almost doubling the handle. So, you know, right now they can, you know, pat themselves on the back a little bit and say, hey, look, we were right about this. Don't fear, better racing will be to come at Saratoga. Not off to a bad start racing-wise, but again, you're right. You know, no fireworks really for the opening weekend, at least on the racetrack.
I agree. I kind of cluster my three rounds of betting around Keeneland, Saratoga, and Breeders' Cup. So like all my betting here is over the last 3 weeks. So I'm the reason that handles up. I was particularly impressed by Momos on Saturday. Didn't quite know what to make of him by Distorted Humor out of a Spikestown mare, bred to be quick and bred to be early, but did he really want the main track? He had a turf work showing. It's kind of hard to know exactly what to do with him. And boy, he just got out there and just ran them into the ground. 75 buyer, and we'll see what Christoph has to say about races like the Saratoga Special and the hopeful going forward. Yeah, the grade one was iffy in quality. But those fillies could be something going forward. I agree with Bill. It's hard to imagine them threatening Swiss Skydiver or Gamin. I thought the digital age set piece allowance on Saturday was an interesting one. I know Joe likes set piece in there, and nothing went right for him.
It's the rail.
That was awkward.
Yeah.
But I took digital age. I thought set piece would give me some value on digital age, and so that proved. And both those are stakes quality horses going forward. So yeah, great to have Saratoga back.
Going back to the handle part of it, you know, I wonder. It's hard to figure this. I don't think there's any way to really measure this data wise right now. I mean, maybe there is, but we haven't seen it. Whether or not we are getting new bettors throughout this period. I think that handle has gone up, but I think there's also less competition. There were a lot fewer tracks running for a while. Now they're, you know, pretty much back to normal. But there is something to be said about, I just want to give a hat tip to Naira and Fox Sports again for, you know, having these broadcasts every day from Saratoga. They had them at Belmont before that, just to have some kind of presence on a major sports channel when there's really nothing going on. I wonder if we've picked up some new bettors, and I think that they do a good job in terms of introducing more novice and beginner bettors to the sport. But you know, that's coming to an end because baseball is coming back tomorrow. Next weekend, we should have hockey and basketball back. I mean, who knows what's going to happen with football? That seems kind of up in the air. We have no idea what the world's going to look like in 2 months when the football season's supposed to start. But I don't know. What's your guys' sense? Do you think we're picking up any new bettors, and do you think it's at all sustainable? As a cynical, you know, racing fan, I would lean towards no. But you know, the handle has been pretty steadily up throughout these couple months, at least at the big tracks.
Well, Joe, this is a very interesting topic, and it's really hard to tell what's going on here. You know, first of all, the figures that came out of March, April, May obviously were down for overall handle because so many fewer racetracks were running. June was a better barometer of what was going on because virtually all the major tracks and almost all tracks, period, were back. And the handle was, if I recall, it was up just slightly in June 2020, or maybe just down slightly. It was pretty much the same versus June 2019. The July figures will be very important to look at as well because, you know, now everybody's back. I mean, even Arlington Park is back now coming into this weekend. So, you know, what we haven't seen yet is, you know, handle is up 10% over 2019 numbers. And that's for the entire sport. But then at the same time, you know, every time these major racetracks like Saratoga, Del Mar, Churchill Downs put out any kind of reports, and you know, the TDN was running these daily handle reports, they're through the roof. So I'm just wondering, is there something where the handle's shifting to the major tracks and the minor tracks are getting hurt? Now, of course, in this sport where transparency is not important to anybody, try getting the daily handle figures, you know, from every single racetrack in the country, being able to compare all the numbers, that's impossible because a lot of tracks just don't even let anybody know what their handle is anymore. So I don't really have the answer to this. It's very interesting. We'll know more in July, et cetera. And that'll also be a month, at least the last week or so, will the sports bettors will seem to go gravitate back to sports now that baseball and everything is back. So I'd like to see more. It's very interesting. And I don't really have the answer, but I lean towards what you've said. I don't think there's been any big explosion or growth among handle, but I'd love to be proven wrong about that.
Yeah, I think there's a glass half full and glass half empty. I kind of agree with you, Joe. I don't see any enduring effects. I did see a tweet that somebody said that the number of new registrations at Naira Bets, I think, was substantially higher. And also, I don't think you can understate the importance or the contribution, at least, of No Del Mar Racing over the weekend and what impact that had on Saratoga handle. Saratoga was the only game in town, quote unquote. Even there were other tracks running, obviously, but as far as boutique meets, Saratoga was in a position to capitalize. So maybe that 10% gain in the first week has to be taken with something of a grain of salt. But hey, you know, the glass half full is, let's let's hope somebody is a novice and sticks around.
I want to jump in real quick on that, because I want to piggyback on what you said. We're talking about handle, Monmouth Park put out a press release afterwards that they had the highest handle in Monmouth history for the Haskell, other than the Breeders' Cup, of course. Now, that looks great, and you know, really taking that at face value, yes, that's fantastic, but that wouldn't have happened if Del Mar was running. I mean, you know, I don't know what Del Mar handles on a typical Saturday, but obviously whatever they that handled funneled into Saratoga, as you mentioned, and Monmouth as well. So, you know, the Monmouth number is a little bit skewed. Then again, to handle 20 million plus and is pretty impressive. But, you know, let's put a little asterisk next to that.
So you guys touched on two things I want to transition to, Monmouth and then Del Mar. Start with Monmouth, because we didn't mention that in our weekend recap. We just mentioned Saratoga. Did have the Haskell, did have some really good racing on Saturday at Monmouth. Good to see Monmouth back as well. They did have some fans out there in like Saratoga. Not sure what the deal was about how safe it was, how strict the protocols were. Always makes me nervous to have thousands of fans somewhere. But, you know, we are in a better place in New York and New Jersey now than we used to. It's not the same as, you know, people crowding the beaches in Florida or whatever. But did have some interesting performances. Before I get to the big one, you had Global Campaign in the Monmouth Cup. He's kind of like a second tier handicap horse right now, but I think he could, you know, over time, and if he string some races together, can jump into that top tier. Aquaphobia, another Mike Maker turf claim that's, you know, just kind of exploded. I thought he always had a little bit of talent, but he's taken him to the next level. He won the UN, got a 102 buyer. Horologist, who Bill did a story on last year in the Molly Pitcher, another good performance. But the main event was the Haskell. You talk about a race that was completely different, had a completely different feel at the eighth pole and the wire, because at the eighth pole, it looked like a 10-length win for Authentic. He really had everything his own way. I don't know whether he was quitting or whether Mike Smith was overconfident. Maybe it was a little bit of both. He was able to hold on at the wire. John texted me. John's not available today, but he texted me that it wasn't particularly a good look to have New York traffic with that trainer, you know, finding another gear in the last 10% of the race. But I think it was a combination of things why that ended up so close at the finish. I do want to give a shout out to Al, who has now surged into contention in the contest. He's got 158 points. I'm still ahead with 260. Brian's got 225. Al jumped up to 158. Tough beat for Bill, I got to say, with New York traffic, because you know, he really did run a good race. And, you know, when I talk about ground loss, I think he was probably best because he was too wide compared to Authentic, who hugged the rail. But Bill's got 80 and John is still in the toilet with 20. We don't have any hope for John the rest of the way. But I think everybody else at least has a realistic chance. And, you know, obviously, a ton of it's going to hinge on the Derby. But I'll toss it over to you guys for what you thought of the Haskell, because that was a race where you kind of walked away from the TV at the eighth ball and then came back like, holy crap.
Well, first of all, mission accomplished for the Authentic team, because they needed to win the grade one for a stud value. They've got that. They've got that in the bank. So in a $1 million race, it was worth a lot more than $1 million to them. But this is going to be the horse in the Derby that nobody is going to like. He's going to be the best horse that nobody is going to pick, because everybody sees the same thing. He's not blowing away the competition. The Haskell, like you said, Joe, it looked like he was going to cruise to a 5 or 6 length victory. What did happen in the final eighth of a mile? You threw out some scenarios. I think maybe the horse is still just kind of goofy. I mean, we saw all his greenness in his earlier starts, and, you know, maybe he was pulling himself up. It's really hard to tell, but, you know, they got the job done, but, you know, nobody's going to look at that race and say, wow, I can't wait for this horse to run back in the Kentucky Derby. Even Baffert, when it was over, you know, said something to the effect, and I'm paraphrasing, that while this is great, we do see that we have a lot of work left to do with this horse. You know, can he improve that much in the next 6 weeks to be a major contender in the Derby? Who knows? But, you know, I don't see any reason to get really excited about this horse for the Kentucky Derby. You know, that's not a knock on him so much as I just think there's better horses out there. And, you know, again, he's going to be the horse that is going to be the anti-wise guy horse. You know, he's going to be on paper, he should be 5-6 to 1. He's going to be 12 to 1 in the Derby.
So I think when I drafted Authentic, I made the comment that he wasn't the perfect horse for me. And this is exactly why. He's managed to do something, for lack of a better term, stupid every time he's run. So whether it was the you know, taking a right turn in the Sham, I guess it was, or missing the break the last couple of times. Now, he left there running. I thought it was interesting that he set the pace off the rail. And sometimes I think jockeys will do that because sometimes the closer a horse is to the rail, maybe they get a little more aggressive. Now, Smith said post-race that he really wanted to get down on the rail, but Authentic wouldn't let him. So I said for the first mile of that race, it was the best Authentic I've seen. And then it almost all blew up. So I'm of the opinion that the horse needed to be ridden like he was head and head. He just needs to be kept busy. He's obviously got his quirks. He's a May 5th foal. So he's got some growing up to do. I mean, he's this good now. I mean, maybe another 6 weeks, you know, maybe they're able to get the light bulb to go on really and truly. But in terms of pedigree, remember that the horse by Elusive Quality was a world second record holder at a mile on grass. Out of a mare by Smile, who won the Breeders' Cup Sprint, almost won the Triple Crown. That's Smarty Jones. You know, you've had the Derby winner by Distorted Humor out of a Suicide mare. So sometimes I think we outsmart ourselves with pedigree and we say, well, he's by Into Mischief out of a Mr. Greeley mare. Forget about him. And I think that's faulty thinking because all these animals are built differently. Charlatan's by Spikestown. You wouldn't think he's necessarily bred to go a mile and a quarter to look at him. He looks like he wants that trip. Obviously, we won't see that. But I think sometimes the handicappers outsmart themselves where it comes to pedigree. And the trainers know these horses best. So bottom line is Authentic is not a horse I want for the Derby, even though he's my number one draft pick. I'll be trying to beat him. But I think he may be better as a finished product. Maybe he's this year's Improbable. Improbable just wasn't ready last year. Maybe he's the horse this year. But I'm against him for the Derby. I think he's got a world of talent. I agree, Bill, the grade one was important going forward. And, you know, we'll see what happens 6 weeks from now.
I mean, I don't want to sell him too short. You know, I think I was watching the NBC broadcast and they were like, Randy Moss had to like stop himself because they were trashing him so much. And they were like, we got to stop and be like, oh, wait, he just won a $1 million race. Let's not throw him out completely. I mean, he does his last three races, he's got 98, 98, 100 buyers. So, I mean, he is running like fast enough, but there's no 3-year-old really. Even Tiz the Law isn't running like 110 buyers. Like they're all kind of in the same ballpark in that way. I think the problem is, like Al said, he's a bit of a nut. He might need blinkers. And he's one of those horses that I think kind of needs things his own way. I don't see him, you know, pressing a fast pace in the Derby and still going on. I think he's either got to be loose on the lead or he's going to be toast. Like that would be my impression of him. Obviously super talented and still is developing, like Al said as well. I think the improbable comparison is an interesting one because he was the kind of horse that I felt like needed a little bit more time last year and, you know, ran okay in the Derby. And then I felt like they kind of jammed him into the Preakness, did not run well in the Preakness. And he really has not been the same. He did come back with a couple of big efforts this year, but his 3-year-old year, I think was a total wash. I think he might be running in the Whitney next against Tom Zetas, which would be pretty interesting, not to digress, but yeah, I think it's a good comparison. But with the Derby and the Preakness being later this year, Baffert has the luxury of being able to develop Authentic and bring him slower along, as all these other trainers do. But yeah, it was a funny race, and I gotta say, I was not Brian's not here to whine about it, but I didn't think Dr. Post did any running at all. Like, I thought he had a pretty good trip, pretty good setup. Like the pace was pretty fast. They came home. The 3-quarter split was 111.5. The finishing time was 150.45. So it's almost 39 seconds. So it's not as if they were flying home. But Dr. Post really had no excuse whatsoever. It was 4.5 lengths on the wire. He strikes me a little bit of a plotter, at least at this point in time. But yeah. You know, overall, it was an interesting weekend of racing at Haskell, so with some good performances that'll, you know, we'll see where these horses go going forward. But I wanted to transition from that because you guys mentioned Del Mar and the fact that Del Mar wasn't running, the impact on handle numbers at Saratoga and Monmouth on Saturday and Sunday. But just, what a bad look that, first of all, they didn't require negative tests for people to get on the grounds. They didn't require negative tests for the jockeys. Saratoga and all these other tracks, I think, are doing mainly the right things. Like, they're trying to separate the front side from the back side. You have to test negative in order to be let on the grounds. But just in this environment, especially when Santa Anita did such a good job, for a track that's like, what, 150 miles away from Santa Anita, have completely different protocols for the jockeys, especially after what happened at Los Alamitos. It was just such a terrible look that 15 jockeys tested positive. That's like almost the entire riding colony. And I don't know what they were thinking, honestly. And it seems to me that they've corrected themselves now and they're, you know, trying to do the right things. But the fact that they had to lose an entire weekend of racing and the return of maximum security, supposedly they're going to run this weekend, but I don't know that that's 100% going to be the case because, you know, there's a 14-day quarantine and incubation period for people that test positive for COVID. So, I mean, they can try to run this weekend, but that makes me nervous too. If any of the jockeys that tested positive are back running already, I don't know that that's 100% going to work out, but just it's so symbolic of like what's happening in the country that some people don't think that the rules apply to them and they're kind of screwing themselves because of it. And I didn't get it. I didn't get why Del Mar wouldn't build on what was successful at Santa Anita with, and especially with such a boutique meet, such a relatively short meet, to have, you know, to play around like this and miss an entire weekend of racing, especially with everything that's going on in California. Like, I don't know why that was the plan. And it seems like there really wasn't much of a plan. I mean, I hope everything goes well for the rest of the meet, but Bill, like, well, what is going on? Why, what was the plan here?
Well, I don't know. I'm not really sure what the plan was. Maybe there was no plan. I don't know. But I just want to, you know, say that this is, like you said, this is sort of emblematic of what's going on in society. Everybody's taking their foot off the pedal. And, you know, we're finding out that you can't do that. And, you know, Santa Anita, in hindsight, boy, do they deserve a huge round of applause. What a tremendous job they did. I mean, it seemed a little over the top, you know, making the jockeys live on the racetrack. But, you know, they had no problems whatsoever. They got through the meet with nobody testing positive. Then as soon as they get to Los Alamitos, all hell breaks loose. You know, I'm not going to get into finger pointing here, but don't forget the fact that this seemed to all really start over that July 4th card at Los Alamitos. Del Mar said that 14 of the 15 jockeys that tested positive rode that day at Los Alamitos. And I'm still not sure if the 15 includes the ones that we already knew about, Espinosa, Pratt, Martin Garcia, or it's 15 new ones. I'm not sure about that. But the other thing too, and John, I don't really know the answer to this, but I think they will be able to run this weekend with no problems because now they're saying it's only a 10-day quarantine period. I don't know what happened to 14 days. All we ever heard was it's 14 days, it's 14 days, it's 14 days. Now they're saying 10. So, and apparently the health department and the hospital they're working with, right down the street from Del Mar, has all signed off on this 10-day thing. So I don't think we'll have any problem running this weekend, though, you know, why it's suddenly become 10 versus 14, you know, I don't have an answer to that, obviously.
It's so hard to understand how could it run so rampant after everything was what seemed in check for the last 4 or 6 weeks of Santa Anita. It begs the question. I think they're going to run as well, and hopefully they've shut this down and they're able to control it from here. Heck, we've got, you know, 5 weeks left in the meet, a lot of important races to get from point A to point B to be run. So I think it's crucial and critical that people take this seriously, and people starting at the top take it seriously, impose whatever measures are necessary to keep the thing going forward. Because any more regression, you're starting to threaten California participation in the Breeders' Cup, for example. So, you know, it's incumbent on them to get their act together and now and not later.
Yeah, and California's racing, as we all know, it's such a precarious position to begin with the governor and everything and all the PETA outrage out there, that this is just more tinder for the fire. to try to get rid of racing, and just, you can't afford it. You can't afford it if you're this sport, and you can't afford it, especially if you're racing and running in California, that, you know, people are looking for an excuse to shut you down and not taking the one thing that everybody in the world thinks or should think that you should take seriously. You know, everybody's talking about it. It's not as if this caught you off guard. Like, this was a really a bad unforced error, and hopefully it only cost them one weekend of racing. But, you know, I think it's interesting to contrast that with Naira and the job that Naira has done, you know, since they first got an outbreak on the backstretch back in March. I think it's remarkable that they were able to contain that and that they were able to come back to racing on June 3rd and really haven't had no interruptions, no positive cases that I know about since then. Now they're up in Saratoga. We'll see what happens there. You know, it's a little bit of a different environment, but, you know, it makes me want to tip my hat to Naira and the New York racing establishment even more, because this was not a given that we were going to be able to contain this thing and to be able to run, you know, going through the summer. And, you know, you gotta, if you're in charge of an American racetrack, you got to know that this thing is not gone. It's not contained, especially in the West and South. Like, this is still a major threat, and you have to err on the side of caution. And, you know, I think you're right that it's not just Del Mar. I mean, I'll be happy to point fingers, but it goes back to Los Alamitos on July 4th. And Victor Espinoza had the quote that they were stacked into the jockey's room like sardines. And it's just, in what scenario do you think that is, you know, a safe environment at this point in American history? It's just, you know, I think we all got to know better by this point. You know, we're almost 6 months into this thing. We all have to have common sense. We all got to know better. We all got to wear masks. And it just, I don't know, it's a bad look, and we got to be better than that. So, you know, that's my shaming corner for the week. You know, we obviously hope that all the problems are behind Del Mar, but it's just, you know, there's really no excuse for that kind of laxness, especially when you're coming from a place in Santa Anita that did such a good job. And there needed to be more communication. There needed to be more uniformity. You know, we talk about that as well, that, you know, there's a lot of problems in racing trace back to the fact that there's no uniform body to set regulations and rules for the entire country. I think this is one of those scenarios that even tracks that aren't that far apart and are in the same state, like, they couldn't get it together and have the same rules. That's pretty staggering to me. So hopefully that's the end of that. But I wanted to transition from that to something that Bill wrote about the other day and that a lot of people have been talking about related to COVID and related to jockeys. We touched on it a little bit last week, where, you know, we have the new rules at Saratoga where if you weren't riding on opening day, you cannot come and ride at Saratoga. If you were riding it on opening day and then you go somewhere else, you can't come back. So that's sparked off a little bit of a conflict where Florent Giroux said last week that if that's the case, that the Kentucky riders should only be able, only the Kentucky riders should be able to ride Derby week. And it just, we talked about it. We talked about Manny Franco, you know, potentially having to sit out a couple of weeks, although maybe now it's 10 days before riding in the Derby. But I don't know, do you think, Bill, do you think that they're really going to be able to keep these New York jockeys away from Kentucky? Because, you know, no disrespect to any of the Kentucky jockeys, but, you know, it's not a deep colony like New York is, and it doesn't have the A-list riders that New York does. And it's just, I don't know, it's going to be, I don't want to pick on anybody. I was going to say like some names at the bottom of the Kentucky jockey standing, but it's just going to be weird seeing some of these guys riding in the Derby instead of Javier Castellano, John Velasquez, like Arad. It's hard to imagine.
Well, I mean, this thing is so complicated at this point, and you're probably right. I mean, I came out and said they shouldn't let out-of-towners ride because, again, you know, same things you've been talking about. The safety is number one. Safety is bigger than the Kentucky Derby and the health of individuals. And, you know, we found out through what we've just been talking about, this mess in California, which, you know, revolves around some of these jockeys like Luis Saez starting all over the country and, you know, testing positive and then maybe spreading it to this riding colony, et cetera. And then everybody coming in after that and saying, no, you can't come, you can't go. We have a lockdown on our rider colony. If it's a normal day, a normal Churchill Downs meet like the spring meet, yeah, they're not going to let these guys come in and ride. for the Kentucky Derby. Do they look the other way, make an exception? Yeah, they probably do, I think, and just kind of cross their fingers and hope that nothing goes wrong. But I want to take this in another direction, if you don't mind. The bigger elephant in the room right now, and you know, something I probably should have touched on in this article more than I did, is the spectators at the Kentucky Derby. And you know, and I didn't, when I wrote this, I in the back of my mind, I didn't really know how to deal with it. Well, if you're going to tell people from New York, Joe resident of Brooklyn, you can come into Churchill Downs and go to the Kentucky Derby, which they're apparently going to do, how can you tell jockeys from New York they can't come in and be at the Kentucky Derby? But when the announcement was made that they were going to allow spectators into the Kentucky Derby, Kentucky was doing great. All their numbers were way down. It was one of those states that everybody was looking at and saying they're doing everything right. The Governor Beshear, you know, was every day giving positive responses at his press conferences. Now the thing has turned 180 degrees and Kentucky is, you know, looks like it might be, you know, along the lines of Florida and Texas and these other states. Matter of fact, on Sunday, they had 979 cases of coronavirus in the state. It was their highest one-day total. Jefferson County, where the Kentucky Derby Churchill Downs is located, is having rampant problems. Does Beshear have to change his mind at this point? I mean, what the heck do they do with this thing? I mean, I'll say this much. You couldn't pay me enough money to get me to go and sit in those stands on September 4th or September 5th with the dangers that would be involved in that. It's certainly not a good idea. And I don't know, you know, but maybe he's just backed himself into a corner. Everybody's backed themselves in a corner right now. And they'll let the jockeys in, they'll let fans from all 50 states in and just say, let's hope nothing goes wrong.
It would seem one of the more foolish ideas to go forward with this plan. I mean, you're 40 days or so from the Derby and the numbers are spiking. The curve is going in the opposite direction. I mean, how do you not backtrack? I mean, anybody with a conscience would have to make the decision to pull the plug on that. So I'm going to be surprised. I'll just say it. I'll be surprised if they're fans for the Derby, and you know, it sucks. It's the greatest race in this country or the most prestigious. And you want to have fans there. You want to maximize your bottom line and all that. But you said it, Joe, safety or Bill, safety has to be the overarching theme. And you have to act with that in mind and let everything else fall into place. So, and who knows what happens with the jockeys. I agree, Bill. I think somehow, somewhere, that an accommodation will be made, you know, 10 days of quarantine before shipping in or something like that, and maybe some similar period upon return. But what a mess. Just, you know, it's just a mess.
It never ends. Like, I remember when we first started doing these podcasts, when the virus first hit, and we thought, all right, we'll do this for like 2 months and then, you know, things will be back to normal. And, you know, it could be 2 years before things are back to normal. It's weird to, I understand why they did it, because they wanted to make plans logistically, but it's weird in this era to announce 2 months out that you're going to have fans at your event. Like, how could you possibly know that? You know, what's the phrase, man makes plans and God laughs? Like, that's kind of how it seems right now, because, you know, there's no looking ahead more than like a week or two in the era of the coronavirus, especially in America, because, you know, as we've harped on, just, you know, people don't do the right things, and we're actually going in the wrong direction still somehow 6 months later. And, you know, it's going to cost us. It's going to cost us a lot. Hopefully, like, these sports seasons can go through all the way, but I'm not going to bank on that. And yeah. How could you possibly, if the rates keep going the way they are in Kentucky, how could you possibly have fans at that event? Even if it's a limited capacity, it's just, I know it's a big deal to the Louisville community. I know it's a big deal to Kentucky. Like, it's a big deal, you know, for racing to have fans at its most, you know, popular event. It didn't look right at the Belmont when there were no fans, but what can you do? You know, this is the hand we were dealt, and this is the hand that we continue to be dealt, partly because Americans don't want to do the right thing when it comes to something as simple as masks. So, you know, it's just like Bill said, it's got to be safety first. Andy Beshear seems like a level-headed guy. I don't think he's going to do anything that would put his citizens in jeopardy. And, you know, Churchill, I think, jumped the gun a little bit, suggesting that they were going to have fans. And you don't, you can't, like I said, you can't really plan more than a couple weeks in advance with this kind of thing. You know, which is just the world we're going to have to live in for at least a little while. You know, even in here in New York, where we've like in New Jersey, where we've, you know, suppressed the virus for the most part, like we're still having to crack down on like outdoor drinking and stuff because, you know, people still, they're over it. They think that's it. This is, you know, we can like go on with our normal lives now. And, you know, we can to a certain extent, but, you know, until there's a working vaccine, it's just, it's not going to be normal. And I know it sucks. It's hard to hear that and it's hard to reckon with it, but you know, it is what it is. This is the situation that we're in. You can't jump the gun on anything. You have to be cautious. And you know, this is a time for us to really rally and in the sport and in America and just be united against this thing. But you know, it just hasn't happened yet. And you know, it's unfortunate. Hopefully, you know, we can get our act together, but I'm not gonna bank on it. Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Check out why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So it was a big weekend for West Point. They have a lot of action coming up this summer, but you know, even in this crazy 2020 world, it's still pretty damn sweet to get a graded stakes win during opening weekend at Saratoga. Decorated Invader, you know, showed up again. I mentioned on Twitter about this that I think he's developed in a way that has made him a better animal because he used to be just kind of a one run closer. And he had a lot of talent always, but now that he kind of has that tactical speed, he was able to track that loose horse the other day in the Hall of Fame and run him down and hold off the other closer. So I think that that's really taken him to another level. I think he's, like I said, he's got to be at the top of the three-year-old division right now. The biggest threat might be another Clamont horse and Gufo. Like I said, we're going to talk to him. But Decorated Invader really rolling right now. He's got three wins in a row. Saratoga Derby is probably coming up next. They got this weekend, they have Seven Trumpets, who's going in the Good Lord Stakes at Ellis Park. We won that race last year. And then the following Sunday, the barn favorite Hard Not to Love is going to go to Del Mar in the Grade One Clement Hirsch. Might get a rematch with Fighting Mad and Cece, which she faced last time in the Santa Maria. But star of the show right now for them is definitely Decorated Invader. And congrats to all the guys and gals at West Point. Another great performance. Al?
Yeah, just on Decorated Invader, I think you're exactly right. And I think really good horses are horses that can thrive when they're out of their element. I really don't think Decorated Invader wants to be that prominent or handy to the pace. I think he actually has a really good turn of foot if the race is run to suit that style. But yeah, he's been ridden up on the pace, and he's been good enough to finish off those races. So I think he's got a monster future. I think he's heads and shoulders the best three-year-old turf animal going around right now. And yeah, Saratoga Derby's worth 500,000 smackaroos on August 15th, and that's where you would expect him to show up.
Yep, mile 316 will be a new test for him. But, you know, that versatility that he's shown in his last couple starts, you got to think he's going to be tough in there. So congrats to all the partners, and we'll see him soon. So we did not get the return, the much anticipated return of Maximum Security last weekend. Hopefully we'll get it this weekend. Del Mar in the San Diego looks to be a fairly easy spot for him. But now the time crunch between that and the Pacific Classic is smaller. I believe it's 3 weeks now instead of 4 weeks. But you know, it'll be interesting to see him back on the track for a new trainer and Bob Baffert. But I just, you know, Bill brought this up, and it's interesting that we really haven't heard about the Saudi Cup yet and like what's going to happen with that purse. Bill, what do you think is going on? What's taking so long other than this being racing?
Who knows, y'all? I mean, this is getting to be crazy. The race happened on February 29th, and the indictments of Service and Navarro, and in this case, Service is the one that matters, happened, what, on March 9th, was it? So we're almost 5 months removed from when Service was indicted. I did reach out to somebody, the Saudi people last week, and they came back to me and they said, we're working on it. What are you working on? I mean, the only thing that you need to know is what happened with the test that you sent on maximum security to a lab they were using in France. Obviously, that test should have come back months ago. I don't have the faintest idea what they're doing, why they're dragging their feet. But, you know, it's not like dealing with people in the U.S. where you know what channels to go through and who you can get answers from. You know, I got a big blank nothing. They did say they might have some sort of update soon, but this is getting to the point it's just kind of crazy. You know, this race was February 29th and it's still hanging in limbo.
Yeah, it's like exactly right. What's left to decide? Here's a test and the split sample that you send that off to. It's 4.5 months later now. 5 months later, let's get some resolution here. But yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see Max back on the track. He's going to carry 127 pounds. Anytime I see a handicap with like 127, that's big weight for this country. But I guess he'll have higher power to deal with, who's a grade one winner in his own right. But yeah, Joe, I mean, it's a race he should be winning.
Yeah, I mean, he seems like he's going to get a good pace set up as well, but it's a good point about the weight. That's like basically man of war weight at this point in American racing. But Bill mentioned this, and I kind of want to jump off of that we are now almost 5 months away from the indictments. And we talked about this at the time where we thought that this was kind of a crossroads for racing, that this was such an earth-shattering, you know, development that it had the opportunity or had the potential to, you know, jar a lot of people in racing into action. Now, unfortunately, the coronavirus news broke basically a week later. And obviously that changed everything. That turned the entire world upside down. I remember the week of the indictments, I was supposed to go on CBC, a Canadian broadcasting channel, on the radio to talk about the indictments. And then like a day later, they were like, sorry, we're doing all coronavirus updates now. Like, I get it. I understand. But we just haven't, there's been like no room really to talk about anything else. But I wanted to look back on it because, you know, this was a chance for racing to get its bleep together and to get, you know, its house in order. And Bill made the point at the time, which was when the feds pack up and leave, you know, what are we going to be left with? And it doesn't seem like, it seemed at the time like there were more investigations and there might be more indictments coming. Well, 5 months later, it does not seem like that's going to be the case. It seems like those were the only ones. That was the only wave. Obviously, Service and Navarro were big names, but there's still people, you know, around the country that we know are juicing that, you know, I guess are in the clear now. And I asked the question, do you think anything has changed since then? And I would have to say no. I still see trainers getting slap on the wrist fines and suspensions. I don't see like any crackdowns on these major barns. Like, Jason, you know, there's a former assistant to one of the guys who got indicted who is winning at like 46% off the claim at Gulfstream. Now, I'm not accusing anybody of anything. Do not sue me. This is all allegedly, but a former assistant to one of the indicted trainers is winning at 50% almost off the claim in Gulfstream. And the idea that there's nobody around that racing office or that jurisdiction that goes, maybe we should look into this. Maybe we should have some extra scrutiny here. Like, it doesn't seem like racing is going to do the right things here. And I think that they got off the hook. And I think there were a lot of people that when that story first broke, they were just waiting for it to blow over and they got lucky. They got lucky that the coronavirus hit and took it off of the front page. I'm not saying they were rooting for the virus, but in terms of the news cycle, they got lucky that the coronavirus blew it off the front page. And I think we're back to the status quo where people are free to cheat. And if they do get caught, they get a slap on the wrist. Maybe they get 15 days, you know, a year later. Like, what have we really done to crack down and clean up this sport? Anything, Bill?
Well, Joe, I think you were a little naive to think that things were going to change or even to contemplate that things were going to change. Because going back to the point I made several months ago, this was not done by horse racing. Horse racing did not catch these guys. It was done by the federal government. And we knew the federal government, the FBI and the Department of Justice was not going to spend all their time worrying about horse racing. There's things that are far more serious to worry about in the world. What we thought would happen has happened. The FBI has packed their bags. They've moved on to the next thing. This thing is going to take its way to wind through the courts. It's going to take forever. And at the end of the day, there's going to be penalties levied against these guys. And I still think that the key characters in this will go to prison, which, of course, I think would be a great thing. But now that the federal government is gone, we're back to horse racing policing itself. Well, if it couldn't do the job right for the 100 years prior to the indictments of Service and Navarro, you know, what right did we have, or what gave us cause to think that they were going to do things right post Service and Navarro? And yes, it is fair to point fingers at the sport of horse racing, but at the same time, you do have to understand one of the differences here is they don't have the powers that the federal government has. The federal government didn't catch these guys by drug testing them. They caught them by using wiretaps and subpoenas and things that are not the access of racing commissions and racetracks. And I don't want to let anybody off the hook. And, you know, I'm with you. If some guy's winning 46% off the claim, somebody ought to do something about it. You know, what exactly that is, you know, maybe it's surveillance. Maybe it's just telling the guy, look, you know, we're not going to put up with this anymore. You know, whatever you're doing, you better stop. But, you know, things didn't change because that's horse racing. I mean, that's sort of a cynical outlook on it, but I think it's also a correct outlook on it.
I don't have a lot to add, honestly. You would think the federal indictments would act as some sort of deterrent. At the same time, they're probably thinking the same way we are. The feds are not going to devote time and resources and dollars to investigating horse racing. It wasn't a horse racing investigation to begin with. It started elsewhere. So, you know, we have got to get the job done internally. And what reason do we have to believe that's going to happen? History tells us it hasn't happened before, and history deems that it's probably not going to happen going forward. It's, you know, it's a sad state.
We're just going to argue about LASIX for another 20 years. I think that's kind of where this is headed. Bill, you said I was naive. I remember a starry-eyed dreaming Bill Finley at the time during when we did that podcast. But you thought there was at least a possibility that racing would clean itself up. Well, obviously, we weren't. I think we were kind of all in agreement that there was a potential, there was a possibility, but we would have to see it to believe it. And now we've seen it for 4 or 5 months, and nobody cares. Nobody cares. It's more whistling past the graveyard, and you know. We love a lot of things about racing, and we are happy that it's back at Saratoga and these major tracks. So there's a lot to celebrate right now. And I think we've done a lot of that, especially, you know, coming out of the darkness of the coronavirus era in racing, where a lot of stuff was shut down. But I don't think that we'd be doing our jobs, or anybody in racing media would be doing their jobs, if they don't at least try to address these issues that are still so rampant, because, you know, you have to hold people to account. And not saying anybody's going to be watching this segment at the end of our podcast and spring into action, but overall, like, it's something that I think we still need to focus on as an industry. And it got put on the back burner, you know, with good reason for at least this period. But, you know, it's not going to fix itself. It's not going to clean itself up. You know, racing has got to do a better job. And, you know, it takes more people speaking out. You know, it takes more people speaking out in higher places than we are. And it's just there. I think there's a lot. There's a fraternity in racing that they don't want to talk about what's really going on, because a lot of people are friends with people who might be doing things the wrong way, or friends of friends. You know, we got to do better. And it's not just going to happen. Like, there has to be public pressure put on people in racing to do better. And you know, it's easy to make a scapegoat out of Service and Navarro and then kind of turn the page. But they were just the tip of the iceberg as far as I'm concerned. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtv.com. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So for this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, we bring in possibly the hottest trainer in all of North America, fresh off of a stakes win Saturday, big weekend at Saratoga. Christophe Clément, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So it's good to have you. So basically, let's just start with this. I feel like your barn has really, you know, taken off since Belmont came back, and now really at Saratoga over the first weekend, it seemed like you were in the winner's circle every other race. To what do you attribute this hot start?
You know, usually a stable like ours, you know, we plan to be, our main thing is to basically be running from April 1st to May 1st in New York until December 1st. So that's the reason why we had a strong Belmont meet. And, you know, we've got a good group of horses, so hopefully we should carry down until the fall.
Just so I don't know, I had a follow-up on that. We talked to Chad Brown, and he said that the pandemic interruption didn't really affect him as much because he has a lot of horses that are laid up over the winter because they're turf horses. Did you find something similar that it kind of just gave you more time to prepare the horses that you were had on the shelf anyway?
Chad who?
Chad Brown. Yeah, I think you heard it. He's the other guy who wins all the turf races.
I had to do something. Sorry. Yeah. Now, I mean, the pandemic has been a challenge regarding the workforce and the organization of the barn and, you know, what do you ship and how do you, in order to get everything organized. But I think we're very lucky in New York. I think Nara and Martin Panza did a great job, and we're just lucky to have racing here at the moment. As you know, most of the help was tested again when we went to Saratoga. So it's probably more challenging for the people who only have the one string. But Chad and I were both lucky because we do have a string in Saratoga, you know, before the meet. That makes it much easier.
Right.
Christophe, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us. We have a lot of questions for you because Joe and I actually were fighting over who was going to ask you the first question and the next question. So since Joe's leading in the contest, he gets first crack.
Always.
I have a couple questions for you actually about your two very talented three-year-old colts. Decorated Invader, who just won the Racing Hall of Fame, the grade two at Saratoga, and Gaffo, who just won the Kent grade three down in Delaware. Both very, very talented. It seems like they're both, going up to a crescendo right now, and both hit 90 buyer numbers in their respective stake wins. You've been very successful at being able to keep them apart. Is there going to be a point in time where you think you're going to run against each other?
Yeah, no, I think so. The next race is a race called the Saratoga Derby or the Summer Derby, where it's like in mid-August. It's a mile and 3/16. I think at the moment it would be the logical step for the two of them. As of now, we're going to train both of them for the same race.
And part of the reason why I'm asking you is because we own Proven Strategies, so we've lost to both horses. So I'm trying to make sure that I can manage our stable to avoid those two big heads at this point.
And you got some other stakes. You can go to California, you know, to the Del Mar Derby, you can go to the Virginia Derby. And you got some other track. And you've got a $100 race, I think, at Churchill on Derby Day.
Absolutely. No, the nice thing about it is there really are a lot of options for a lot of these horses. And, you've been very successful not only on the turf, obviously, but also in the dirt when you won the Belmont with Tonalist. And that was a really interesting race because you actually defeated California Chrome, in his quest for the Belmont. Tell us a little bit about going into that race when you won your first Triple Crown jewel.
So we liked Tonalist very much. And, the plan was to go for the wood to get him ready for the Derby, but he did not train well. The week before the wood, I can't remember. He had a disappointing work. And basically, we passed on the wood. The horse went, we just gave a bit of time. Put him back to New York, trained great. Went for the Peter Pan, where he won very impressively in the slot. And I actually thought he trained as good as Oscar trained to go to the Belmont. Wasn't sure to win because you're never sure to win that kind of races, but I was pretty sure to be very competitive. And it was a very exciting race. Everybody remembers it as, the day California Chrome got beat. For me, it's not a negative. It's a positive. I remember it as a day Tonalist won. And I was just thrilled. And also, I've been a big supporter of Tonalist, as a young sire. And so far, so good. He's doing well, so I'm pretty excited about that.
I wanted to ask you about some of the two-year-olds you have and might have going forward at Saratoga. There's a really impressive one on Saturday in the first race, horse named Momos, who was by Distorted Humor, who won off and became a TDN Rising Star. What have you seen from him to think that he might be a grade one horse? And do you have any other two-year-olds that haven't run yet that you're similarly excited about?
Yeah, we know. I'm lucky. I've got a very good group of 2 years old this year, so that's exciting. Momo came from the cell. He had a fast work at the cell, so we knew he was fast. If you look at him, he's all about speed. I mean, he's built like a very fast horse. He's not a big, horse, but he's very well balanced. His first three or four works by design were slow with us because I did not want to see too much speed. But whenever we asked him, he showed a lot of speed. I gave him a blowout a few days, 4 or 5 days before the race, where he went, he's very fast. He's not fast, he's a very fast horse. That was my only instruction to Franco. I told Manny Franco, we knew the horse was very fast. Not to make it too complicated, just break well and do not interfere too much. And he gave him a very good ride and he was always in control. That's pretty exciting.
Are there any other ones that you haven't run yet that are maybe getting close to running that you're excited about?
I've got quite a few, actually, that you were exciting me. We've got a very nice Go Zapper for West Point. It was a nice horse. I've got quite a few coming up. We've got the Tisna Call for the Marchment partnership, which is also exciting. I've got a few grass horses coming up. And I've got a good group of 2 years all put together.
And Joe, since you mentioned two-year-olds, we want to remind everyone that in New York, the two-year-olds are not running with Lasix. And Christoph, that's been, you've been very outspoken about that, about not only not having two-year-olds with medication, but also re-examining the medication rules and what's going on in our industry. It's certainly been a hot topic for us, since the beginning of the year. What else can the industry do realistically to try to clean up some of the trainers that may be, testing positive for banned substances or over-medicating horses?
The Lasix is not that big of a deal for me. And I think actually the Lasix is a non-issue. I just think it's foolish to run 2 years old on Lasix. They start their career. If they're bad bleeders, then just turn them out and give them some time. I have not used Lasix over the last 3 or 4 years, most of my 2 years old, until basically they were a proven bleeder. But otherwise, I try to avoid it. So it's something, but I don't think it's that big of an issue. The medication, in the meantime, is a very big issue. I don't think that the penalty is strong enough. I don't think a trainer should get 1 or 2 weeks. I think we should be able to make, in today's world, in the backstretch, we're well aware of it, we should be able to make a difference between somebody who makes what I call a stable mistake, who gets 2 weeks and a fine, and somebody who is using any kind of medication to have an edge, who is getting the same suspension. And that's not fair. It's not right. So we need to have stronger penalty. If you have stronger penalty, I promise you things will change.
I wanted to ask a little bit about turf racing. I think you're one of the guys who, really uses his connections in Europe really well to get these prospects over and then, turn them into, terrific North American turf horses. But I feel like there's a little bit more competition because of that guy you said you never heard of, Chad Brown. I think there's a little bit more blood in the water in that way. Have you found it any harder to try to get those European prospects over to America? Do you think there are more people looking that way with the increase of turf racing in America?
No, without a doubt, because one is obviously he's very good, and two, he's got a lot of money behind him, so it makes it very tough. And also we should, in the past, we were able to get a great trios like $400,000 in France. You have to pay $750,000 to $1 million to get the same horse today. So the market is completely different, which is one of the reasons, like somebody like me, I've got a lot more American owners racing American horses versus European horses. Because really, I cannot, most of the time, I cannot compete money-wise. So I've got to try to find some new venue. I'm much stronger into the New York Red program than I used to be. I've got to try to find a place where you can still be competitive without spending a crazy amount of money.
Right. And can you talk about some of the connections that you have over in Europe that have helped you kind of bring some of those prospects over?
Yeah, no, I'm French. My father was a trainer in France. So I know every single trainer who is like 40 years old or older in France, I know them well. The young one, maybe not quite as well, but I know all the agents. My brother trained in France. So I know very well the form in France. But the competition and Mr. Brandt and Mr. Brown also use different agents and they buy very good horses and they've got very good people working for them. So you just have to try to find either horses who are not running at the major tracks that they have not seen or really, most of it's not 20 horses who are good to buy from France every year. There might be two or three max. And unfortunately, you know, you're almost better off to look into other countries or other venues to try to find the same kind of quality.
Okay, easy question for you. As somebody who has a son now who's working for you in the business, biggest career excitement of your life, was it Tonalist winning the Belmont, you winning your 2000th career victory this year, or the first day your son came to work for you?
So my wife might be behind me, so I'll have to say my son working for me.
We're trying to give you a nice, easy one.
but the truth is, my biggest excitement, I think, was my first winner being my first winner, because I was 25 and I was very young. It's very exciting when you have your son working with you, even if it's pretty challenging, because we disagree quite often, but it's okay, because we have to explain each other in a rational way or point of view. So I think it makes both of us better, and I think that's a good thing.
So I hesitate to bring this up because I don't want to make you relive it, but there was a tragic story with your barn earlier in the year. You guys lost 10 horses that were on the way to join your stable in a trailer fire. What helped you guys cope and get through that and kind of move forward? Because I remember, I think you guys won two races the same day that happened. So how did you guys kind of cope and move forward from something that tragic?
I don't know you cope with that. I think, you know, I got that phone call. It was, I think, 3:45 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And you got to deal with the state trooper. You just don't cope with it. It's like the worst of the worst. I'm lucky in a way because I trained for amazing owners. So in a way, they made it easy on me. But no, nobody can cope with that. That's the worst.
Right.
And does anything in your career as a trainer, whether it was in Europe or working with Chuck McGahee or anything like that, does anything prepare you for a difficult conversation like that? How do you call up the owners and explain to them what happened?
Well, I think you always go to the truth. Just tell people the truth. Tell them what's going on. And, everybody's got drama in his life and everybody's aware of it. But in general, that's one thing, I try to teach my son is... stick to the truth. Don't make it too complicated.
Yeah, and but before we let you go, I wanted to ask about the filly who won on Sunday in the stake. Speak to me of Summer. Obviously got a good trip with Rosario, had to win a stretch battle. What do you think about her prospects going forward?
I think she is nice. You know, we liked her last year. Went a bit disappointingly at Belmont. She went very well the other day. She got a great, great trip with Joy Rosario. At the moment, the options would be either the Saratoga Oaks, Mile Entry 16 Saratoga mid-August, or to aim her for the Del Mar Oaks if we can ship her and if it's not too complicated to get to California at the time. She's nice. And also very rewarding because she's by Summerfront. And, you know, I trained Summerfront for the same owner. And that's another young sire who's doing well. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I was gonna ask about that. If it's any more gratifying to see a horse that you train start to throw these good horses that you then get to train as well.
I think it is. You know, it's the same when you train, when you're lucky enough. You know, I train for a lot of owner breeder, and I think it's always a little bit more rewarding when you train for an owner breeder because you know the dam and you know they're trying, and you know people have put years into it. Whenever that horse wins a race, it's 4, 3, 4, 5 years of thinking behind it. So it's always very rewarding when you are lucky enough to train for an owner breeder. If you train a horse who is by the side that you've trained, for me, it's also gratifying because that horse, you know, is standing at Airdrie. Airdrie, you know, the shoulders that feel as a fall. So it's very much a teamwork for all of us.
Right. So I got one last question and then we'll let you go. You've been very generous with your time. Going back to Gufo and Decorated Invader, I know you don't want to look too far ahead, but, you know, at the end of the year when they're going to have to face older horses, do you think there's one that's a little bit more likely for maybe the Breeders' Cup turf, one that's a little more likely for the mile? What do you think about their distance probabilities going forward?
At the moment, you know, we train the two of them for the same race. And then after that, you know, one of them probably would be aimed to the race in New York or the Belmont Derby at Belmont. One of them could go for the Kentucky Down race, which is also worth a lot of money, in September. To tell you about, you know, meeting the older horses by the end of the year, they've both been running since the spring. I'm not sure they will go on to October, November. I hope so, but they might need a bit of time at some stage. When I train Japonte, you know, it's a big mistake. A lot of people, very often the 3-year-old, you know, by the time you meet the older horses, instead of yours going up, it starts to go down just because we've been going on since the spring and they need a bit of time. If they're both doing well, I'm very happy to take on the older horses, but if they will need time, then you know we can wait until next year to take on the older horses.
Gotcha. Anything else, John?
No, that was wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. We greatly appreciate it. It was an honor.
Great stuff, Christoph, and best of luck the rest of the meet. Can't start much better than you did.
Thank you so much. We keep trying. Right.
Thanks, Christoph. Thank you. Be well. Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Christoph Clement will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
So that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Remember, entries for the industry-leading 2020 Keeneland November Breeding Stock Sale to be held at the home of the Breeders' Cup are now open through August 3rd. Learn more at november.keeneland.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, Alan Carasso, John Green, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Christoph Clement, our producer, Patty Wolf, our editors, Anthony LaRocca and Danny Siper, and our production coordinator, Michelle Sobrino. Thanks for watching. Wear a mask. We'll see you next week.